She is the only living American winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. She's been described as one of America's greatest authors and one who's helped shape the narrative of African-American life in America from slavery to the present day. But Toni Morrison's stories are so much more than history lessons. Her writing also delves into the complex and powerful relationships, emotions, and motives of her characters, challenging simple stereotypes about victimhood and villainy. And we are so pleased to have Toni Morrison with us now to talk about her latest work, A Mercy. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It seems almost odd just to call you Toni Morrison. I feel like there should be some title attached. Her diva-ness, her majesty, something. You have this effect on people. People have been circling all day wanting to just see you. Is that odd to get used to?
It's not me. It's the books. If they make some connection and they're involved in it, they transfer that to the author.
So it's a gift.
It's a gift. It's a compliment.
I want to talk about A Mercy. It begins with the voice and follows the story of Florence.
Yes.
A teenage girl of African descent, enslaved at the dawn of American history in the 17th century. In a political narrative this year, we've talked a lot about this being a post-racial age, if it indeed is that. But Florence is essentially pre-racial, at a time when many people, not just black people, were in bondage. And I so want to know why this era engaged you.
Precisely because it was, I guess pre-racial is good enough. It certainly was pre-racist when slavery had not yet been coupled with race, when most of the world were slaves, and they may have been called serfs or peons or peasants or what have you. But empires rested on the labor of people in bondage. And that was not the exotic part of the origins of this country. But it became an unusual relationship when certain things happened and the aristocrats and the landed gentry needed to protect themselves from the poor, which in this case were itinerants and they were indentured servants from Europe and they were enslaved Africans and enslaved Native Americans. So the solution in one instance in Virginia, which took root elsewhere, was to say that it was the invention of white people, really, which is another title for the book, that any white person could maim or kill any black person for any reason and be protected. So that is an immediate division, you know, between the various levels and kinds of poor people. And the benefit was only to the rich.
I don't know how much patience you have to talk about your method, but the book begins in Florence's voice, and really it is her story. It's a narrative about her journey, several journeys. I wanted to ask, how did her voice come to you?
That I can't really explain. My question to myself was, I wonder what it felt like to be a young slave black girl when there was no racism, the feeling that you are loathed genetically. And then when I posed the question, at some point I just heard this voice, and literally the first words were, "Don't be afraid." And then when I learned more about her, I realized that she would speak in the present tense, and that would give her language, set it aside. Also, it was accurate for her because everything is now, you know, urgent now.
She's a teenager.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
A right teenager now. In love. I mean, you know, they don't have a past. They just have him or her, as the case might be.
The story is told, though, from a variety of perspectives. It opens with Florence in her voice, but Florence belongs to the household of Jacob Vark. And I want to talk in a minute about why she's there. Mm-hmm. But the other voices are Lena, who's a Native American woman, who is in essence a slave. I don't know if they really call her that. Rebecca, the wife of Jacob, which is an interesting biblical, who was sent to Jacob as a male order bride, essentially, from England. They are all bound.
They're all in various stages of enslavement, sometimes, you know, the coarsest kind of exchange. But when you read the advertisements and the pamphlets of the time, everybody was for rent or for sale. and sometimes for hire, but generally not, and particularly young people, children. They were motherless, fatherless, they were vulnerable. People just picked them up. You've read all those stories, perhaps, about being impressed on ships and just picked up off the street and sent places. Dozens were sent to Virginia, and they were European children. And some of them were supposed to be free after 7 or 8 years, but they weren't. Any infraction, you could extend their contract.
And who would enforce it anyway?
Yeah, there was no law. It was lawless, literally. And when there was law, it was somebody who owned the land, or it was a church, because if you belonged to a flock, you could abide by those rules. And they sometimes involved slaughter, so that the churches and the institutions that had run from persecution were themselves frequently persecutors when they got to this country.
These women and girls, and there's another young girl, Sorrow,
yes,
who is just
Sorrow,
who has just this, who has this history as a castaway child. I mean, mm-hmm. was a child on a ship, and everybody on the ship seems to have been slaughtered, so she's there too, and is essentially silent, although it's kind of the, anyway. But they all become kind of a family for a time.
They do.
But it doesn't last. Why doesn't it last? Why can't it?
Well, the family structure that they invent in isolation, they don't belong to any club or church, or they don't have any rights of law except this land that he inherits. So they construct, as Americans frequently did, a family of disparate parts. But it was held together, as families frequently are, and certainly then by the man. He was the glue, and he was the head, and he was a decent man. So when he goes, when he dies, they are left at their most vulnerable point, including his widow, who really has the inheritance, but she doesn't have the resources to stand alone. Some of the others do. And sometimes, as it turns out, Sorrow, this girl who starts from zero, who's like nobody, imagines along the way and becomes, through pregnancy and the deliverance of a child, she renames herself Complete. So I was interested in what happens when people have all the support systems kicked out from under them. Who survives? Who becomes an adult? Who collapses? Who chooses the wrong path, or a path that may be satisfactory but is lesser? Lena remains with her mistress, even though their friendship, which is what they really had, deteriorates. Because the important thing for her, the nobility for her, is loyalty. And her loyalty is so important to her that it does not depend on the worth of the person to whom she is loyal.
You know, speaking of Lena, and so many of the critics have commented on the deliciousness of your descriptions of the landscape. I mean, it's just the description of what it was like to step into the marsh and the trees and the sunlight. But one of the things I noticed is that many of the characters are very respectful of the land and of animals. Like, there's a scene where Jacob frees a raccoon from a trap, and he's about to intervene when some sailors are beating a horse, but they traffic in human beings. What do we make of this?
Well, nature was dangerous. It was a real threat. Being wild was really being loose, and you could die if you weren't careful. You know, snakes and predators and all sorts of things could bother you. So there was what you describe as respect, was the respect of something that could seriously hurt you, that was not at your mercy.
I have read that you did a tremendous amount of research to get
right.
But you didn't have to, because I wouldn't know. We weren't there. Why is it so important to you?
Well, I need to feel comfortable myself as a writer. I had to know what it looked like, what it felt like, what the weather was like, all of that. So that now my characters are in an environment to which they're constantly reacting based on something that's really accurate. So I had to do that kind of research.
We have to take a short break, and we'll have more of this conversation in a moment. But before we do, we want to play a short excerpt of Miss Morrison reading from A Mercy exclusively for NPR.
Her voice was barely above a whisper, but there was no mistaking
its urgency. Please, senor, not me. Take her. Take my daughter. Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, God help me, if this is not the most wretched business.
That was Toni Morrison reading from her new book, A Mercy. You'll find links to the special edition of NPR's Book Tour podcast on the Tell Me More page of NPR.org. Coming up, part two of our conversation with Toni Morrison. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to continue our conversation with Nobel laureate and Pulitzer Prize winner author Toni Morrison. She joined us in the studio to talk about her new book, A Mercy. Ms. Morrison, I want to go back to the character of Florence and the section where she comes to the household of Jacob. Now, her mother had asked Jacob to take Florence to settle a debt in a scene that may remind some people of the novel Sophie's Choice. Now, you've tackled the topic of slavery before, particularly in Paradise and the work many people consider your masterpiece, Beloved, and you focused on some of the brutal choices that slavery forced on women. But I have to tell you, there are times when, particularly as a mother, this story brought me to my knees, thinking about what it must have been like to hand over your child. Now, you're a mother yourself, and I wonder, how do you go to such a place, even think about such a thing?
If I'm going to bear witness to these really terrible things, I have to tell myself that I don't have to do it, I just have to imagine it. And that is hard enough, because the really, you know, of the monstrous things that slavery in this country caused was the breakup of families. I mean, physical labor, horrible. Beatings, horrible. Lynching, death, all of that, horrible. But the living life of a parent who, A, has no control over what happens to your children, none. They don't belong to you. And you're not responsible for them. You may not even nurse them. They may be shifted off somewhere, as Beloved mother was, to be nursed by somebody who was not able to work in the fields and was a wet nurse. But that division is traumatic. Sometimes there were other things, you know, where women literally threw their children away because their fathers were crewmen or sailors or somebody they didn't know or like. And I remember Beloved, the man says, she put her arms around your father, which is quite different. So even in A Mercy, there was a urgent request or an encouragement for me to make it possible for Florence to hear and know and understand why her mother gave her away. And I resisted it completely, because the truth is she would never know. The fact that she becomes tough the way her mother would have wanted her to be is because of the circumstances of her own journey. But she never hears, she never knows, as many of them did not, who these people were, who were their parents, where were they. And you do feel that enormous abandonment, which she felt all her life.
Florence's mother at one point says, there is no protection, but there is difference. Mm.
She knew one really, really terrible situation, which was the one she was in. And when she sees Jacob Vark, her master offers her as a payment of debt. And he doesn't want to be involved in slavery and all of that, and debt by human flesh. And so he refuses. But she has seen in his eyes, she believes, something unusual. She said, "He looked at you," meaning her child, "not as pieces of eight, not as money, but as a human child." So, yes, there's no protection for a female, but there is difference, and this might be better. So she takes the risk.
One of the things that other commentators, critics have noticed is that there are no cardboard characters here. There's nobody who's just simple. There's no, like, you know, twirly mustached villain here. Even I could argue the most disgusting character in the book, and it's kind of hard, you know, there's some competition for that, is the Portuguese slave trader to whom Florence originally belongs, has his reasons and doesn't. See, you know what I mean? He's not a one-dimensional
character. He's a businessman.
He's a businessman. And at least he entrusts her to a priest who has taught her, who has allowed them to learn to read and write.
Exactly.
And then Jacob himself is an orphan who has made his way in the world. What are you telling us about
how
we
should... People are complicated, and that's what's interesting about us. The caricature or the cartoon figure has a place in cartoons, I think, and in some other... you know, agenda that I sometimes am impressed with. But if I really want to enjoy and invest in a piece of art that is representative of the magnificent landscape of human beings, then I need complicated people.
If we were to read A Mercy as in part an allegory of the American story, you know, there's so many elements that people who... think about American culture will instantly recognize the way we reinvent ourselves, the way we take pieces from a history that many of us don't particularly know as well as we wish we did, and we sort of construct it, the way we create new selves for ourselves, but it does fall apart. How shall we read this?
Well, look at the people in the book who did invent themselves. Lena is a prime example of that American invention. Her tribe was wiped out when she was little. She gets pushed into a Presbyterian home. So she begins to construct herself. A little bit of this, what she remembers from her tribe, what she remembers from the Presbyterians, what she thinks of, her own love relationship that went so sour. Sorrow, the character, just, you know, completely becomes an adult at that moment when she is literally responsible for another human's life, her own. And Florence, her whole journey of executing her own story, she's telling her own story, and begins with the kind of a plea, "Don't be afraid, I'm not going to do this again." But by the end, the person to whom she speaks, she's saying, "Are you afraid? You ought to be." That's a whole different human being. And it comes through her ability to tell her story, to glean its meaning, and to become something very close to an adult human being, whatever her fortunes are. So I just wanted everybody there not to just be that person static. Even Jacob, who has had this long journey and who loathes the whole business of slavery, is willing to get a nice big house to profit from slavery, although he doesn't want to be intimately related to the labor of slavery.
He doesn't want to see it.
No.
He gets involved in the rum trade where it's removed.
Exactly, don't say it. The way we are from sweatshops and all sorts of places where people are paid a nickel and we get the socks cheaper. We know that. And of course, we are correct. They are alive and not dead, and they're being fed. You know, you can rationalize practically anything. And he does that in order to have what also becomes an American characteristic, which is the acquisition of something excessive, a bigger house. He didn't even have children anymore. But he wants this big house because he envies the Portuguese slave.
Whom he doesn't even respect.
Whom he hates. But you understand that what was exciting for me, and I hope the reader gets some of that, is how ad hoc everything was, how fluid, and the unlikeliness, the unlikelihood of this nation becoming what it is. It started with everybody and anybody, with competing interests. And before, it was both Eden and hell. I mean, it was anything could happen.
What do you think the books mean for people? What do you think these stories mean to people?
I think it's a...
Because they're not easy. They're not easy stories.
No, they're not. And that's one of the reasons I think that when people connect with them, they do really connect. You know, it's like complicated music that when you tap into it, it's almost ineffable. You cannot even say why it is that important to you. And if you love it and you recognize something about yourself or about other people or about the world, and it's clarifying and enlightening, and even when it's sad, you see this kind of survival triumph, and people learn things at the end of my books. They know stuff. And when that happens, it certainly happens with me when I read books like that, you might be inclined to transfer that gratitude for that insight and that experience to the author in addition to the book. So now you've got live flesh to smile at, and that's fine.
Well, I'm happy for that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Our guest is Nobel laureate, Pulitzer Prize winner, diva of divas, yep, Toni Morrison. We are talking about her latest novel, A Mercy. We talked at the beginning of our conversation about the fact that this book takes place at a time that's pre-racial, at least pre-racist. And a lot, mm-hmm, of people now call this a post-racial era. Do you buy that?
Mm-hmm. I sort of don't like that word. I don't know why. But it seems to indicate something that I don't think is quite true, which is that we have erased racism from the country, and that certainly isn't true, or the world. Racism will disappear when it's, A, no longer profitable, and no longer psychologically useful. When that happens, it'll be gone. But at the moment, people make a lot of money off of it, pro and con, and also it protects people from a certain kind of pain. If you take racism away from certain people, I mean vitriolic racists, as well as the sort of social racists, if you take that away, they may have to face something really terrible, misery, self-misery, and deep pain about who they are. And it's just easier to say that one over there is the cause of all my problems.
What do you make of Barack Obama's election? What do you think it
I was
means?
Very, very pleased, exhilarated even, with his election. And I also was proud of the country. That is, it chose not to be terrified all the time, not to be so cowardly, and not to always scream about who's going to get them. Of course there's danger in the world. We're in the worst position I think I have seen. I'm 77, this country in. But they chose to work for the democracy that they have long loved, to actually put it on the line and not just succumb to hatred and to actually look forward to what the promise of the country is. And that's brave under these circumstances.
Did you honestly think that this day would come in your lifetime?
No, I never thought that. I was very, very surprised. Pleased and surprised. And it wasn't, you know, I keep saying it wasn't an African-American who won the election. It was this particular man, this one, not another one that I wouldn't vote
Fungible.
For.
Fungible, yeah. Just interchangeable.
Yeah. On the television, it's like, oh, the African. No, no, no. This man, it's time enough.
I understand he called you and asked
oh,
for your
did.
Support. I'm sure he's called you more than once. I know I would if I had your phone number, but but he asked you for your endorsement. You don't generally endorse people. I don't remember you ever endorsing anybody. Did you actually wind up endorsing him?
I actually wound up, which is difficult. I never endorse publicly any politician. You know, I'm very rabid about whom I support personally, but I never do. And he just asked, would I, if I thought well of his campaign and so on, would I do it? And I told him that. And he said he understood perfectly, because if I did it once, then I might be constantly asked, and he said, think about it. I said, I would think about it. And he mentioned some event, you know, a fundraiser or something that I was welcome to attend. And I sort of, you know, I was interested really in him because of his book, Dreams from My Father. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, he was a real writer type.
That's a compliment coming from you.
Oh, man.
Did
no,
you
really.
Tell him? Did you tell him you thought well of his
yeah,
book?
He said a few little things about Song of Solomon, and I sort of acknowledged that he was a writer also in my high esteem.
I'm surprised he can still fit his head through the door.
Well, that's the thing about Obama. He can still fit his head through the door. And then I left it up in the air because I was very happy with Hillary Clinton in that campaign because I've been an admirer of hers for years and years. So I began to seriously evaluate, not in terms of who could win, and not in terms of, oh, this one is a woman and this one is a African-American. I mean, you know, things are too tight for that. I couldn't settle on that. So I began to look at them, what I thought was carefully. And then I decided that I would endorse him. And afterwards, he, you know, just called to thank me for the letter. I've never met him.
You've never met him?
Mm-mm.
Well, what about inauguration?
Mm-mm.
Are you going to come?
What
are you?
I don't think so.
What?
I'd rather see it. I don't think so. Too many people. What am I going to do? Just sort of, oh, no, I can't.
Be a diva?
No.
Wave at people?
Yeah, with
let them come
three
and
fingers.
Line up
no,
to
no,
kiss
no.
your ring
no,
the way
no.
they're doing here today?
No. That's not me. That's some other
Are you going to do anything special to mark it?
I'll think up something.
Okay. You mentioned that you were fascinated by his book, his life story. A lot of Americans are. Do you think there might be something in his story for you as a writer?
No, it's very different. I mean, his ability to reflect on this extraordinary mesh of experiences that he has had, some familiar and some not, and to really meditate on that the way he does, and to set up scenes, you know, narrative structure, dialogue, conversation, I mean, all of these things that you don't often see in, obviously, in the routine political, you know, memoir, biography. But I think this was when he was much younger, like in his 30s or something. So that was impressive to me. But it's unique. It's his. There are no other ones like that.
Well, there are no other ones like you either, so... What's next for you? Anything on
yeah,
your mind?
I have things on my mind, none of which I feel bold enough to tell you. But
perhaps we could entice you to come back and see us when you
that
are ready
you
to tell us.
That you can do.
Toni Morrison is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize, among many other honors. Her latest novel, A Mercy, is available now. And if you want to hear her reading from it, you can go to NPR.org, where she has read a number of chapters of the book. Toni Morrison, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, this was a delight, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.